Welcome to the 262nd episode of the 4th and 24 podcast with Patrick Winograd. I'm your host, Randy Winograd. In this edition of the podcast, our topics are an overview of Patrick's weekend predictions, an overview of the NBA playoffs, and our weekly look at Major League Baseball action. So let's jump right in with a look back at Patrick's weekend predictions, which are posted every Thursday on our website, 4thand24.com, and we will start in the NBA, where Patrick went 2-0 with his predictions. And turning to Major League Baseball, Patrick went 3-1 with his Major League Baseball weekend series predictions. That brings his record to 5-1 for this week, and his overall record to 1,073-685. That's a 61.0% winning percentage. Patrick, your thoughts on your weekend predictions?
Well, I have lost, I think, less than one game in each of the last two. It's always a good sign. Yeah, I went 3-1 in MLB last week. And went undefeated in the NBA for the second week in a row, so that's always good. But yeah, starting in the NBA, the Mavericks beat the Timberwolves 109-108. We will talk about this more later, but that was, of course, the game where Luka Doncic hit his game winner over Rudy Gobert. And then the Celtics beat the Pacers 126-110. Both of those were, I believe, game two in those series, but just on different days. Yeah, they were both game two. The Mavs game on Friday, the Celtics game on Thursday. Then in MLB, the Brewers took 2 of 3 from the Red Sox. That one I predicted the wrong. The Red Sox had been playing pretty well heading into that series, but not their finest work, especially offensively. Only managed to get 7 runs across the entire series. The Brewers beat them 7-2 and then 6-3 in the first two games. Then the Red Sox did win the Sunday game to avoid the sweep 2-1, but wasn't enough, of course. And then you have the Royals, who took 2 of 3 from the Rays. They were on an 8-game winning streak before that series ended. Of course, the Rays actually did take the final game in that series to stop the Royals' win streak. But at that point, they had swept the A's before that and then swept the Tigers and then won the first two against the Rays, winning 8-1 and 7-4. And the Rays won the final game 4-1. And then the Yankees took 2 of 3 from the Padres, took the first two and then lost the Sunday game. And then the Twins took 2 of 3 from the Rangers. Same story there. The Twins took the first two, and the Rangers took the final game of that series. But overall, pretty satisfied with my predictions. I obviously can't do much better than that. In all those series in MLB, the first two games taken by the teams I picked. So pretty good overall, and I'm pretty happy with it.
Okay, well, Patrick's predictions for next weekend will be posted on our website, 4thand24.com. As always on Thursday, let's now turn our attention to the NBA, and we will start with the Western Conference Finals.
The Mavs, of course, leading this series 3-0 so far. Game 4 will be later today. All these games have been close individually. You know, the first two games decided by a combined margin of just 4 points. But Dallas did take a 2-0 lead on the road. No team has ever come back in the seven-game format from losing the first two games at home. Obviously, teams have come back from 2-0 in the past, but not when they were the team at home, the higher-seeded team, obviously. So, an uphill battle that Minnesota will be fighting, and then made it even worse by losing that Game 3, which, of course, zero teams have come back from that either, and that one a much larger sample size, and also has nothing to do with home and road, just has to do with the control of the series overall. But you know what? It still has been a close series overall. So I guess there's a chance that, you know, Minnesota could have been up 3-0 in the series if they had made the right plays at the end of the game. But that's kind of the problem. They are not the team that's really honestly built to do that. The Mavs are just too good offensively. Even though the Timberwolves are playing, I think, honestly, pretty good defense, the Mavs just have better shot makers that just supersede that defense no matter how well they play. But going back to game one, Kyrie Irving and Luka Doncic both scored 30 points in this game. Luka with 33, Kyrie Irving with 30, Derek Jones with 8 points, and PJ Washington with 13 as kind of the other big contributors. Derek Lively also had 9 points and 11 rebounds. But that game, you know, not great shooting from the Mavs, 24% from 3 overall, but you know, those two, Luka was 12 of 26. Kyrie was 12 of 23. The only problem was that Luka was 3 of 10 from 3. But overall, pretty efficient from the two from in the paint between both of those guys. And then it's been well documented at this point, if you've been following the series, Ant has not been on his A game. He had 19 points in this game, but on 6 of 16 shooting. He was 5 of 12 from the three-point line, though, so he was shooting pretty well from the three-point line. Speaking of shooting well from the three-point line, Jaden McDaniels had 24 points on 6 of 9 from 3. I should mention Ant also had 11 rebounds and 8 assists, so a decent overall game for him, but it did get worse later in the series. Karl Anthony Towns, meanwhile, 16 points, but on 6 of 20 shooting, and, you know, good production off the bench. Nas Reed had 15, Kyle Anderson had 11, but again, just not enough to beat the Mavs, who shot a better percentage, out-rebounded the Timberwolves as well, and overall, in the turnover battle, pretty much even. 13 to 10 isn't that big of a differential, and the Mavs actually lost that, but the rebounds definitely made a difference. The Mavs shot better from the floor, and as a result, they won Game 1. And then in Game 2, and obviously they definitely had the advantage of the free throw line that has been a constant throughout the series that, yeah, maybe we'll talk about it, maybe we won't. Although in Game 2, I actually should say, to argue in favor of the Mavs here, the Timberwolves were 26 of 32 from the line. Meanwhile, Dallas 15 of 22, so they attempted fewer free throws by 10 in that game, but still came out with the victory, of course, because of that shot that I talked about, Luka Doncic over Rudy Gobert at the very end of the game. Big shout-out in this game to the centers for the Mavs. Daniel Gafford and Derek Lively combined for 30 points on 14 of 16 shooting. That's a really hard combo to beat. Just a lot of efficient, just dominating the paint, really. Even though, obviously, Rudy Gobert is the guy, you know, roaming around in there. That's Defensive Player of the Year, but Derek Lively and Daniel Gafford having no issue scoring at will in the paint. Kyrie, not as great of a shooting game, but still had 20 points, 6 assists. PJ Washington had 10 points as well. Derek Lively, like I said, 14 points off the bench. And then you had Luka, who had 32 points, 13 assists, and 10 rebounds. 5 of 11 from 3. This game, the Mavs shot 38.9% from the 3-point line as a team, so a lot better in this game. Of course, Luka's shot being the big difference maker in the end. And meanwhile, on the Timberwolves side of things, Ant did not lead the team in scoring once again. It was Nas Reed in this game, who had 23 points on 7 of 9 from 3. He was 7 of 8 and then missed the shot at the buzzer that could have won it for the Timberwolves. But three other guys in double figures, Mike Conley with 18, Karl Anthony Towns with 15, Rudy Gobert with 16. But again, Karl Anthony Towns shooting 4 of 16, Ant shooting 5 of 17, when your stars combine to shoot 9 of 33, you're not going to win the game against a team where, you know, even though Kyrie had an off game, it wasn't a terrible game. 7 of 16 is, you know, a shot below 50%. It's not awful. And he also shot 4 of 7 from the 3-point line. So, you know, the Mavs' best players are finding other ways to contribute. They're playing better when it comes down to the stretch of the game. And, you know, the Timberwolves players just aren't. It's kind of simple in that sense. And then in Game 3, it was the same story. You know, the Timberwolves came back. Ant kind of sparked himself alive in the middle of the third quarter. Had a big third quarter after a big dunk that he threw down. He hit a few mid-range shots. But then he got into takeover mode a little bit too much and took some ill-advised shots for sure. He definitely started drawing more of the Mavs' defense and had a few nice kicks off of that. But there were probably a few more other possessions where maybe he could have kicked it out to a teammate and instead took a shot either near the double team or when it was about to come. He kind of forced a shot up to make sure that they didn't get that double team fully off. And as a result, the Mavs win 116-107. They were just better in the clutch. Ant did have a better game, though. 26 points, 9 rebounds, 9 assists for him. Karl Anthony Towns, though, 0 for 8 from 3. 14 points, 11 rebounds, 3 assists, 5 of 18 shooting. As a team, they shot 9 of 30 from 3. Mike Conley and Jaden McDaniels, though, shot 7 of 11 combined. So if you take those two out of there, it was 2 of 19 as a team from the three-point line for Minnesota. That's just not going to get it done. Like I said, though, Mike Conley did shoot well. He had 16 points. Jaden McDaniels had 15 points, but also was dealing with some foul trouble late in the game. Nas Reed with 14 points off the bench. Again, Kyle Anderson had a big third quarter before Ant really started to kick it into high gear towards the end of that third quarter. And that really kept the Timberwolves in the game. He hit 5 straight shots on his own. But then on the other side of things, Kyrie and Luka both scored 30 again, and this time their most efficient combined performance of the series. Luka Doncic with 33 points, 5 assists, 7 rebounds, also had 5 steals in this game, which is pretty rare for Luka. But the Mavs, meanwhile, only turned the ball over 14 times compared to the Timberwolves, who did turn it over 10 times. But again, a lot of live-action turnovers that the Mavs got. They were a lot of steals compared to the Timberwolves, maybe getting, you know, a few more out-of-bounds passes, you know, charges, that kind of thing. And those don't make as much of an impact because you can't get out in transition. Meanwhile, Mavs shot 50% from the three-point line, 56% from the field. Like I said, Kyrie and Luka were really, really efficient. 5 of 11 from 3 for Luka, 10 of 20 from the floor. Kyrie, 12 of 20, 3 of 6 from 3. Derek Jones was 3 of 3 from the three-point line, had 11 points. And P.J. Washington had 16 points as well. The Mavs shot 31 free throws in this game, which was definitely a sticking point for Anthony Edwards, but I don't really think it meant that much considering that the Timberwolves literally shot one extra free throw than the Mavs did in game two. So not really a good thing to complain about. I don't really think that's the reason why they lost the game. Frankly, if I were to look at anybody, I would look at Karl Anthony Towns going 0 for 8 from 3 and also continuing to shoot early in the shot clock, step back threes late into the game when he clearly didn't have it. That was kind of the sign for me that, you know, Ant and Cat were taking some pretty bad shots, whereas the Mavs were making sure they were getting to their spots. And even if they were taking slightly contested shots, it was Kyrie, it was Luka. They were having good games, unlike Cat, who was clearly off, but still kept just deciding to take some shots that, you know, maybe you should only be taking when either the game is really close and the defense is just that tight, or it's the end of the shot clock, or you're having a great night. But Cat wasn't having a great night. Definitely shouldn't have had the green light to shoot those shots, but he did anyway. And then the other thing is, you know, Minnesota made the adjustment to take Luka out. Sorry, Minnesota made the adjustment to take Rudy Gobert out at the end of the game after that Luka shot and everything that happened in game two. But it really didn't pay off that much, and then they had to put him back in. So it was kind of an interesting attempt at a chess match there from the Timberwolves coaching staff. I don't think it really worked out how they intended it to, though, at all. The Mavs, like I said, shot 56% from the field, 50% from three as a team. So not much getting done on the defensive end for the Timberwolves, and overall the Mavs just dominating the series in the clutch time when it matters the most.
All right, well, let's move our attention over to the Eastern Conference Finals, where we have a winner.
Yeah, the Celtics swept the Indiana Pacers. Obviously, Tyrese Haliburton not playing in the final two games, just like Donovan Mitchell didn't play in the final two games against the Cavs, of course. But look, first game of the series, I think, was where the series really could have changed tones. Obviously, that sounds crazy because, well, I mean, it was a short series, so I mean, it is kind of fair. But at the same time, sounds crazy. But look, the Pacers had a lead in this game. It took Jaylen Brown hitting a three at the very, very end of the clock with just 6 seconds left, down three. The Pacers turned the ball over and then, they turned it over with 8 seconds. Jaylen Brown made a three with 6 seconds left to tie the game. And then Tyrese Haliburton missed a three that would have won the game for the Pacers. And then the Celtics, of course, won game one, 133-128 in overtime. If you want to look at some individual performances there, every starter on both teams in double figures, something that you rarely see. But, you know, this long of a game with short rotations like these teams have, it kind of does make sense. Pacers actually had 7 double-figure scores in this game, which is crazy, but Haliburton had 25 points, 10 assists, 3 rebounds. Pascal Siakam had 24 points, 12 rebounds, 7 assists. Miles Turner had 23 points and 10 rebounds. Nembhard had 12 points, 7 assists. Aaron Nesmith had 14 points and 6 rebounds. As a team, the Pacers shot 37% from 3, so they could do a little bit better than that. But off the bench, too, good production again from Obi Toppin and T.J. McConnell. Obi Toppin with 15 points, T.J. McConnell with 13 points and 4 assists. Just really, honestly, a good performance offensively by the Pacers. 38 assists in this game. They shared the ball really, really well. But at the same time, it wasn't enough. Even though they shot 54 from the field and 37 from three, the Celtics shot 48% from the field and 33% from three. But the big difference in this game is that, look, the Pacers play a different style than the Celtics. The Celtics are inside a lot more than they are, and as a result, the Pacers only shot 10 free throws in the entire game. The Celtics shot 30. So the Celtics took that big advantage. Also had 13 offensive rebounds that helped them out. And that really was just the big difference in the game. Indiana also had 21 turnovers, so even though they had the 38 assists, they were getting a little overzealous with their passes. Some of them worked out well, some of them didn't. And in the end, Jason Tatum, 36 points, 12 rebounds in this game. Drew Holiday, 28, 8, and 7 for him. And then Jaylen Brown, 26 points, 5 assists, 7 rebounds for him. That was a big difference. Those three guys playing really, really well for the Celtics, all combining for 26 points each. And then Derek White and Al Horford both had 15 points. So good performances all around, really, from the Celtics. Didn't get as much from their bench as they would maybe like to, but you know what? They won the game. It is what it is. And again, that was really the tone setter game for the Pacers, because it became a common thread in this series that they didn't play well in clutch time. The series started the same way it ended in game four. They didn't score for the last 3.5 minutes, which we'll get to that more later, but I'll go to game two now. This one a little bit more dominant from the Celtics' perspective. They kind of got a lead early on in this game and then never really looked back. Pascal Siakam did have 28 points on 13 of 17 shooting, but other than him, not much production offensively. Halliburton only took eight shots, scored 10 points. Nembhard had 16. No one else in double figures other than Obi Toppin with 11 off the bench. A lot of guys stuck on 9 or 8 points. But then meanwhile, on the Celtics' ends of things, Peyton Pritchard had 12 points off the bench, but the biggest story, of course, was Jaylen Brown and his 40 points for the Celtics. 14 of 27 shooting, so not too many shots to get there. Derek White, meanwhile, 23 points for him with 8 threes taken, 4 of them made. Drew Holiday, 15 points and 10 assists, a nice little double-double for him with a 6 of 7 shooting performance, too, so really, really efficient from his perspective. And then Jason Tatum, 23 points, 6 rebounds, 5 assists. About all you can ask for, really, on the Boston side of things. 53% from the floor, 41% from three, and then 17 of 20 from the line again. Only 10 turnovers. So really just limiting the bad stuff. Keeping up the good, won the turnover battle one more time. And then in game three, of course, series shifted to Indiana. Halliburton was injured in the middle of game two, but then in game three he did not play at all. Jason Tatum had another strong game, 36 points, 10 rebounds, 8 assists for him. Jaylen Brown, 24 points on 10 of 18 shooting. All the other starters were in double figures. Al Horford had 23 on 7 threes. Drew Holiday had 14. Derek White had 13. And of course, Drew Holiday came up with the steal at the end of the game when the Pacers could have taken a shot to take the lead. Drew Holiday gets the steal, gets fouled, hits 2 free throws to seal the game after the Pacers. You know, the Pacers did run a play and had a shot, a decent-ish look at the end of the game, but you know, Aaron Nesmith was 0-for-2 from 3 in the game and actually had just taken 3 shots before they gave him the ball at the end of the game. So a little bit of an interesting decision, but it's kind of hard to do, to run anything at the end of the game when you don't have Halliburton in there. So you're not going to give the ball you can't really give the ball to Nembhard. You'd want to try to use him as a decoy, I guess, is really what they were thinking. They got 2 guys to go with him, and instead Nesmith was open, but you know, you just hadn't really been in that game that much in terms of the scoring column. And look, T.J. McConnell had 23 points, 9 rebounds, 6 assists off the game, so good performance from him. Nembhard had 32. Miles Turner had 22. Pascal Siakam had 22. So they picked up the scoring where they needed to. It's just that, you know, without Halliburton on the floor, they're still missing a little bit of kind of that energy pushing the floor as much as they would want to. And then they also just didn't shoot well from 3 as a team. They were 5 of 22 compared to the Celtics, who, you know, they did chuck up a bunch of them, only made 35%, but that's not a terrible percentage. 16 threes overall. And as a team, just enough scoring to get them over the edge with that great play by Drew Holiday. And of course, as I mentioned in the final game of the series, the Pacers did not score in the last 3.5 minutes of the game. So Derek White hit a 3 to break the tie. That was 102 to 102 with about 40 seconds left. And that was all the Celtics needed. Derek White had 16 in the game. Jaylen Brown had 29. Tatum had 26 points, 13 rebounds, 8 assists. Drew Holiday had 17, but I mean, really, nothing else that's super strong offensively from the Celtics. The Pacers, kind of same thing. Nembhard had 24, so he did a really nice job, honestly, stepping up in this these playoffs, really, throughout him. You look at the shot he hit against the Knicks. You look at how he played with Halliburton out in these two games. You can tell that those two in the backcourt are a really, really strong duo for the Pacers that are, I mean, super, super young, both of them. So they'll be back in the future. They will have a good team in the future. A lot of these players, super, super young. We'll see what happens with Pascal Siakam and if they end up retaining him next year. But overall, Pacers had a strong year, honestly. I don't think anybody expected them to get this far after kind of their slump in the middle of the season. But that nagging hamstring injury that really caused the Pacers to slump when Haliburton originally went down, it came back again in the playoffs, just at the wrong time. And that's the reason why they went out. They still had a pretty close battle in the series with the team that was definitely favored to beat them healthy or not. So the Celtics going to the NBA Finals probably will be facing the Mavericks. So I don't want to jinx that, but they probably will be. But look, everybody expected the Celtics to be here. This is exactly what they should have been doing. It's exactly what they did. They've dropped two games so far. I don't see them dropping many more after this either. I do think that they are the favorites, and they've been clear favorites for a while. But just some unfortunate circumstances for the Pacers. Celtics easily taking the series.
Yeah, easily taking it 4-0, but the games weren't all easy, really, except for game two. So some really entertaining games for a sweep, maybe the most entertaining 4-0 series.
Until the Mavericks and Timberwolves series ends.
You took the words right out of my mouth, and despite Halliburton's absence and the Mavericks-Timberwolves series 3-0, and those games have been probably more entertaining.
Closer.
Pretty interesting. You could have two sweeps here with very, very entertaining action. So that wraps up our look at the NBA for this week. We'll now turn our attention to our weekly review of Major League Baseball action, starting as always in the American League East.
The Yankees lead the AL East with a record of 37-18. That, of course, is only behind one team for the best record in baseball. We'll talk about that team later. I guess technically by percentage, they're also behind Cleveland, but you know, that's a weird percentage thing of who's played more games. But then you have Baltimore, who is in second in this division, just 4 games back of the Yankees, only in the win column, same amount of losses for those two. They have won 4 in a row. Yankees 7-3 in their last 10, so good signs from both of them. Yankees plus 92 run differential. Easily the best pitching staff in the American League. Not really close either. And also best in the majors entirely. But Baltimore also pitching pretty well. Definitely a strong offense there. And then you have the Red Sox, who are holding it down in third place. They did take the series from the Rays in the middle of the week last week. But now, of course, you have the Rays right behind them because of the fact that the Red Sox took that series. 27-26 for the Red Sox, 26-28 for the Rays. So not much separating them, but the Rays are in fourth place. And then, of course, the big slump at the bottom of this division. Just somehow a team that has no offense despite pretty much being built to hit a lot. The Toronto Blue Jays, 23-29, sitting in last. I mean, if you had told me that the Blue Jays would be 12.5 games back of the Yankees this early at Memorial Day, I would assume that the Yankees were like 50-4. But, you know, that sometimes that's just the way it works out. The Blue Jays have not had a great start to the season, especially with their offense, the worst offense in the American League East. Worse than all the teams in the Central, except for, of course, the White Sox. And worse than all the teams in the AL West, except for the Mariners. So the third worst offense in the American League, and the Mariners have one of the best pitching staffs in the league to carry them and keep them afloat. The Blue Jays have a good pitching staff, but hasn't performed up to expectations, frankly, and definitely not as good as the Mariners is anyway. But then you have the Cleveland Guardians in first in the AL Central. If the playoffs started today with an uneven amount of games played, I think Cleveland actually technically would be ahead of the Yankees. But regardless, they've won 9 games in a row. So Cleveland on fire right now. Jose Ramirez definitely on fire. He said in a press conference yesterday that he was... someone asked him about getting the Barry Bonds treatment from the Angels, and he said he was better than Barry Bonds, which is really funny. Jose is a little bit of a character. But look, he has been... I mean, he's been playing like he's Barry Bonds. Frankly, Aaron Judge has been playing that way for the Yankees, too. So both of those two teams anchored by their superstars. Jose Ramirez is definitely an undermarketed, undervalued, underappreciated player. Aaron Judge definitely an adequately appreciated and adequately marketed player. But J-Ram's up there with the best players in the game, and he does not get talked about nearly as much as he should. But there's a reason why he is leading this Guardians team, and they've had some other great performances from some other players that you wouldn't really expect either, between David Fry and Tyler Freeman for sure. But they've been a good team. But you know what? The Royals have been just as good, only 2.5 games back, despite the fact that Cleveland has won 9 in a row. Because like I said earlier, the Royals had won 8 in a row heading into their Sunday series finale against the Rays. That means that even though the Twins had their surge towards the beginning of the season, you know, the Twins, 28-24, still are 7.5 games back. They are still in the wild card, of course, if the season ended today. They would be a wild card team. They'd have a better record than the Mariners, who are leading the AL West anyway. But then you have the Tigers. The Tigers look like the quintessential 80-82, 78-84 type team. I really don't see this team as a playoff threat, but, you know, they're a team that if you're not playing well, they're going to take a series from you, no matter if you're one of the best teams in the league, or easily they'll take a series from you if you're one of the worst teams in the league. But when they're playing right, they can honestly take a series from anybody. I just don't think they're the type of team that can build enough sweeps, build enough wins against good, really good teams to actually make a playoff push, especially in a crowded American League. Maybe in the National League they'd be able to make it, because the National League has lost its depth this year, but we'll talk about that in a second. Then, of course, you have the ever-disappointing Chicago White Sox. 157 runs scored on the year, despite playing 54 games, which is a less than 3 runs per game pace. Just a horrible, horrible, horrible offense. Also, it doesn't help that they have the worst pitching staff in the American League. So, all of that amounts to a minus 116 run differential. They are terrible. They will stay that way. Then, of course, in the AL West, this division is honestly pretty bad in and of itself. The Astros have started to play better, but they're still 3.5 games back. The Mariners, 28-26. Every single team in this division has a negative run differential. It's kind of crazy that rarely happens. But the Mariners, 28-26, 4-6 in their last 10. They're just kind of staying afloat. They really need to pick it up on the offensive end if they want to make the playoffs, because frankly, they have a 3-game lead in the division right now, but in the wild card, they would actually be out of the playoffs if the playoffs started today. Technically, if the playoffs started today, they'd be a half a game ahead of the Red Sox. They'd barely make the playoffs, but the fact of the matter is, they need to start playing a lot better, because Texas and Houston are right behind them, and I still think that Texas and Houston are bigger threats over the course of the season than the Mariners are. The Rangers still have Eovaldi out. They still have a bunch of injuries that they're dealing with, waiting for Scherzer to come back, all that stuff. And then on the other end, you know, the Astros, they have been playing better recently. They're 6-4 in their last 10. They had a big winning streak to climb out of last place in this division, but, you know, they're still at 24-29. But the fact of the matter is, the Mariners just needed to build separation in this division while those two teams were slumping, but they just weren't playing well enough themselves. The top three in this division just haven't played like the best versions of themselves, and as a result, it is a close division race of two teams under 500 and then one team barely above. And then, of course, at the bottom of this division, you have the A's at 22-33. Remember, they were 17-17 at some point, so I'm going to keep going back to that number. The A's were 500, 34 games in the season, almost a fifth of the way through the season. They were at 500. And then since then, of course, 5-16. So pretty bad from the A's. And then you have the Angels, who have lost their last 3 in a row, 20-33, taking last in this division while Mike Trout is out and, you know, the rest of the team has kind of fallen apart as a result of that.
All right, let's move to the National League, where we will also start in the East.
The Phillies have the best record in baseball. They have been playing great baseball, especially pitching-wise so far. They do lead the league in runs scored, too, which definitely helps. But they are playing really well on both ends. Definitely pitching, though, I think the more impressive part, because we know that this lineup is top-notch. But, you know, the pitching staff doesn't necessarily always follow that. But Ranger Suarez has kind of been a breakout candidate this year. Wheeler and Nola having, you know, I don't want to say career average years, because they're really, really good pitchers. They're all-star caliber pitchers, but... I guess you could say even above their career averages, which when you're normally contending for an all-star appearance every year, that means you're having really, really good years. So the top three of their rotation is just insane. 38-16, of course, their record. Then you have the Braves at 30-20. 6 games back, and, you know, for a while I was saying that, you know, the Braves were inevitably going to catch up to the Phillies, but Ronald Acuna, it's been announced, is out for the season. So now I'm not so sure about that. I do know that the Braves are still built very well. And, you know, not having one player doesn't necessarily change that. But it is still a six-game differential. The Phillies are still built well enough that I think, you know, 2021, the Braves kind of made their way into the playoffs and then stormed through it even without Ronald Acuna. But I don't think this year is going to be that type of a story. I think people will still take them seriously because of the fact that they won without Acuna before. And now they don't have Spencer Strider either. So you could argue the Braves' most valuable two players, Cy Young in the NL, probably the leading Cy Young candidate for this year at least, Spencer Strider and the reigning MVP. And they're both out for the season for the Braves. So not looking good for them. The Phillies probably should be able to hold that down as long as they don't have any serious injuries of their own. Then you have the Nationals, really the rest of this division, all 13.5 or more games back. Nationals at 23-28. The Mets at 22-30 had a really, really, really bad stretch over the last few weeks, but did pull it together to get one win against the Giants. Then you have the Marlins, who are 19-35 at the bottom of this division, the second worst record in the National League. But overall, just a weak division. Although the Marlins are 7-3 in their last 10. I do think this is going to end up as one of the weaker divisions, though, because the Braves will probably be one of the final wild cards at this point. I think they'll kind of start to slide throughout the rest of the season. Although at the same time, when you look around the NL, I still think that the Braves without Acuna and Strider are still probably better than most of the other wild card teams. As crazy that is, as that is to say, when you look at A, some of the injuries on the other teams, and B, just how are they performing. But moving on to the Central, you have the Brewers at 30-22, the only team with a positive run differential in this division. They have a 3.5 game lead over the Chicago Cubs, who have lost their last four games and now have fallen to 27-26 on the season. Meanwhile, the team that's the reason they've lost those four games in a row, the St. Louis Cardinals, have won five in a row. They are 25-26. So the Cardinals, actually pulling it back together, are now a half a game out of a wild card spot. Meanwhile, the Cubs are only a half a game up on the final wild card spot, who of course is being shared, which of course is being shared currently by the Padres and the Giants. We'll get to that in a second. Then you have Pittsburgh. Again, Paul Skeens doing his thing. Has had many, many good starts in the majors so far. Jared Jones doing the same thing as a rookie. But, you know, in the end, it's going to be about can their offense produce? And so far, the answer has been not really. And that's why they're a little bit under 500. And then you have the Reds, who are 23-30. They were 6-20 in their last 26 before sweeping the Dodgers over the weekend. And speaking of the Dodgers, they still do lead the NL West by 5.5 games, still have the second best record in the National League, technically tied with the Braves on winning percentage, even though the Dodgers have played an extra five games somehow. Of course, part of that being the Soul Series, the other part of that, I don't know how that happened. But look, Dodgers still leading their division. They have lost five in a row, though, including two to the Diamondbacks, lost that series. But at the same time, still up on the teams in their division, as we've talked about before. The Padres at 28-28 and the Giants at 27-27. It was announced that Jung Hoo Lee is out for the season, so that's not a great sign for San Francisco. And meanwhile, the Padres just, they kind of don't play well against anybody that's not the Dodgers for whatever reason. It's not even a thing where they kind of play really well against big name teams and then don't do that against the little guys. I mean, look, they played horrible against the Rockies. They do tend to do that every year for whatever reason. But look, the Yankees came into town this weekend and they looked flat in the first two games of the series. So it is just the Dodgers thing, actually. It's not a big teams only thing. They really only show up to play the Dodgers. No idea why. I could not tell you. You know, I've heard some analysts say, especially Dodgers ones, that it might just be a lack of focus thing for the Padres, but I'm not here to diagnose that at all. It is a little strange, though, that this team could take the series from the Dodgers when the Dodgers are actually playing decent baseball and then just stay as a 500 team for the rest of the year, because they're not a 500 roster, honestly. I mean, they have some really good pieces on that team, especially offensively, and then you look at Robert Suarez, who hasn't given up a run in the last 20 innings that he's pitched, their closer. So, like, they have good pieces. It really doesn't make sense they're not winning. Meanwhile, the Giants, having a little bit of a mini 2021 moment for themselves, they're 27-27, even without Jung Hoo Lee playing for the last week or so. This roster should not be playing as well as it is when you consider who's injured for them and who hasn't come back yet. But you know what? They have strong pitching. They have a pretty good bullpen. They're just kind of solid across the board, and that's just enough to keep them afloat. If they can get a few breakout performances in the second half of the season from younger guys or even from some of the older guys, or if they can be aggressive at the trade deadline, I think they could make a strong run at the NL wild card when you consider just how weak it is overall. I mean, they're sitting currently in the wild card spot tied with the Padres, even though they're just 500 on the season. So I don't really think I don't really think the Cubs are going to be a team that soars multiple games over 500. So, I mean, this is a team that they could play 500 ball for most of the year, catch fire right at the end of the year, and that would be enough to make the playoffs. And I think that's easily within the realm of possibility. And then you have the Diamondbacks at 25 and 28. I don't know what to make of this team, honestly. They have good pitching. Some of it's been injured. They've had Corbin Carroll had a really, really rough start to the year. Gabby Moreno, same thing. That's kind of really the only hole. Those are kind of the two holes you can poke in the roster. But other than that, they've been pretty good. I mean, there's a reason why they're 25 and 28, even though two of their maybe top five or six hitters are having really bad years. Ketel Marte has like a 20-game hit streak going, even though his average has dropped during his hit streak, which is really weird. But look, they're playing like an average team right now. They could still do what they did towards the end of last year, though. They had like a 50 or 60 game stretch where they almost challenged the Dodgers for the division for a little bit before the Dodgers kind of turned it on and ran away. So it is possible that the Diamondbacks could just do that again this year and easily make the playoffs. I don't think they're going to be very far back, no matter how long this slump carries out. But they are still a good team on paper. They'll get better as the year goes on. And then in last, you have the Rockies, who are 18 and 34. They do have the worst record in the National League because of how well the Marlins have been playing recently. But, you know, the Rockies have been playing a little bit more respectable the last few weeks here, and maybe that'll continue for the rest of the season, but they're still not a very good team.
All right, that wraps up our look at Major League Baseball action for the week. It also wraps this edition of the 4th and 24 podcast. Please be sure to check out our next podcast, which will be on Tuesday, June 4th, where we will once again look back at Patrick's weekend predictions, have a look at NBA playoff action, and our weekly review of MLB action. In the meantime, please be sure to check out Patrick's additional content, including his picks for next weekend's games that will be posted, as always, on Thursday, and his MLB power rankings, which will be posted tomorrow. All of that content on our website, 4thand24.com. That's the number 4, THAND, the number 24.com. Thank you for listening.